Judiciary Committee. Bad day. Today is Tuesday, January 13th, and we're going to introduce folks in here, but I want to say especially that this is a joint meeting, and Senator Mao and I are going to gather all the witnesses from the judicial branch and solve your problems. So identify folks here that that are on the committee and would like to be recognized, starting on this end.
Greetings, members and guests. My name is Eric Dick. I'm Senator Mua's new committee administrator.
Thank you.
Chris Turner, Senate Fiscal Analyst.
I'm Kathy Pontius, Counsel for Judiciary, the Civil Law Side.
And Mackis, Counsel for Judiciary, Civil Law Side.
And obviously, I chair the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I want to welcome all of you to the hearing today, and I want to thank the judicial branch for accommodating us. It's important for us to set a context as we move forward, and this clearly, as I, in discussion with Senator Foley, I indicated this would be a very good judicial branch 101 for all of us. So thank you so much for coming and providing us with the information.
Thank you. Leo Foley, I've already been here, so.
Oh, Eric Riesling, Committee Administrator, Judiciary Budget Division.
I'm Kelly Holmes-Jagfeld, Legislative Assistant for Senator Foley.
Senator Mary Olson, Senate District 4, just north of Brainerd up through north of Bemidji.
Don Betzold, I'm in the northern suburban area of Fridley, Moundsview, Springley Park, and Blaine. I serve on the Judiciary Policy Committee as well as the Judiciary Budget Division.
Bill Ingebrigtsen, District 11. Counties of Todd, Douglas, Grant, and Stevens. I sit on the on Leo's committee.
Thank you. And now, Sue Dosell, are you taking command?
Will do. Thank you so much, members of the committees, for inviting the judicial branch here today. Give you a little overview. As we understand that you would like a presentation on three general areas. Sort of the history and background of state funding and what has been accomplished since the completion of the takeover. What are some of our current challenges that we face in the judiciary? And a discussion of access and service delivery initiative that we have underway right now, where we are attempting to do all that we can to drive down costs but keep access and service delivery to the maximum extent possible, given
Mr.
Sello,
just a minute while I introduce Senator Higgins, the chair of the Crime Prevention Committee. Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you. Turning to the state funding history, I think as all of you know, historically, the funding for the trial courts was borne primarily by the trial courts. Until we began the process, about 73% of the total cost for the trial courts was borne by counties and 27% by the state. The movement to state funding has a long and storied history, about a 15-year transition process. It was studied extensively and had a broad base of support throughout this whole period of time. The process began in 1988 when the legislature, at the request of the counties, asked that the Supreme Court form a task force to look at the issue of financing the trial courts. The court put together a task force that was comprised of legislators, county commissioners, county administrators, union representatives, judges, court administrators, sort of the whole gamut, and studied this issue for several years. They came up with a recommendation unanimously that the funding for the trial courts in Minnesota ought to be assumed by the state on a phased basis. Now, this recommendation actually would put Minnesota where the majority of states have been. There are more than 30 states that whose trial courts are state-funded. The goals that were articulated for state funding were as follows. First goal was to achieve equitable levels of judicial service regardless of the property tax capacity of a particular county in which an individual lived. Now, the concept here was that the brand of justice you get in Minnesota ought not depend on where you happen to live. The second was administrative unity for the judicial branch. The judicial branch was, of course, the only branch of state government of the three that had previously been required to go to 87 different places for its funding, the 87 counties. With 87 different funding sources in the past, we essentially had 87 different court systems. So state funding allows the judicial branch of government to achieve, really, for the first time, real administrative unity. So policies and procedures could be articulated and enacted branch-wide and implemented with consistency. And resources could also be provided and allocated to the judicial branch of government rationally across the state. The third goal was budget accountability. Now, recognizing that absolutely no policy for the judicial branch is made at the county level. It's all made here, right here in this capital by the legislature and in terms of substantive policy and by the Supreme Court in terms of procedural policy, practice of procedure before the courts. So the idea here was to bring together at one level of government the policymaking responsibility along with the funding responsibility to implement those policies, thus enhancing budgetary accountability. The fourth was a property tax relief, and this state funding was a mechanism to deliver property tax relief to the counties by relieving them of the escalating costs for the justice system that at the time was far outpacing the general inflation rate. And finally, cost efficiency and effectiveness by eliminating these 87 silos, independent silos of budget and personnel, and moving to a single source of funding. This gives the judicial branch the maximum flexibility, management flexibility, to shift resources across county and district lines to meet workload demands and to take advantage of economies of scale that a larger enterprise would afford. Now, how was it funded? The funding mechanism had some complexity and varied some throughout this 15-year period of time, that journey that this took. But generally speaking, the state takeover was accomplished by the state assuming the cost of the county court and the county's HACA being reduced dollar for dollar that amount, minus the county revenue that was transferred to the state. So in the first year of transition, essentially it was a wash. Thereafter, the counties were relieved of further increased costs for the courts, and that was the responsibility of the state. As I indicated, this was a long journey, 15 years. It began in 1990 and stretched over to 2005. And as you'll see, we have gone through a number of steps to get here. It began with the 8th District Pilot Project. In your packets is a map of the judicial districts if you haven't are not familiar with them. The 8th District was the smallest and at the time really the poorest of our districts, and it was brought over as a pilot project. In that same year, we began to bring over additional elements. The judicial district employees, we had some technology costs at the local level, cost of law clerk salaries. 1992, we brought over additional elements. 1993, the jury cost. In 2000, the 8th District pilot project was finally made permanent. And we brought over at that time the three western districts, the 5, 7, and 9. So the whole western half of Minnesota was now state-funded and some additional costs. In 2001, we brought over all of those mandated services costs. And it also in that year, in that legislative session, set the schedule for bringing over the remaining large districts, six of those districts, two a year, beginning in 2003, and being completed finally on July 1 of 2005. As I indicated, I think we had five goals, so I want to talk a little bit about the achievement, and we believe we've been very successful in achieving the five goals that were set out for state funding. The first was the equitable delivery of judicial services statewide. You know, as judicial districts were brought over to state funding, they came with whatever budgets the counties had provided for them. These budgets were based on the relative wealth of the counties, the relationship between the counties and the courts, and the like. So what we found, of course, as we came over, there were some have counties, some have districts, and some have not. So to deal with the first issue of state funding, the equitable delivery of judicial services, we began in a very to make some difficult decisions, frankly, to reallocate internally funding given to the judicial branch so that based on workload, resources were given to each of the districts in an equitable manner. And you can see that before the final completion of state funding, we had a broad range of allocation of resources spread from 85% of need to 114% of need among the 10 districts. We internally reallocated in the following year, and then again in 08, and finally in this current 09. And now we have gone to a situation. The good news is that our districts have equitable allocation of our resources. The bad news is because we don't have enough funding, we're all equally underfunded at about 92% of need. By completing the state takeover, we have, of course, brought together the policymaking and funding responsibility and therefore achieved this budgetary accountability goal that we had. One example of how this played out is our guardian ad litem program. When we brought that over from the county responsibility in 2001, at the time there had been, since 1977, a federal and a state mandate that there be a guardian ad litem appointed in every case of child abuse or neglect. When we brought it over to the state, into the state system, we found out that fully 40% of the kids out there did not have guardian ad litems appointed. And by restructuring those systems and totally reforming them, coming to you and asking for some additional funding, within just a several years, we moved to 100%, virtually 100% of kids having guardians ad litem, as was mandated for a quarter of a century. But it didn't happen until we brought this to the state and had that funding and the policy making in one level. Today, the current funding decisions that you have about the judiciary will pose that same kind of question. If we do not have enough funding, what parts of what the judiciary does will we not do? And that will be a dialogue, I'm sure, that we're going to have in the coming months. We've also, of course, delivered on substantial property tax relief. As I indicated, ever since the trial courts have become state-funded, the counties have been relieved of the increasing costs for the judicial branch and therefore avoided those additional costs for government. In terms of administrative unity, this was achieved on July 1 of 2005, the same day that we completed that state funding transfer. By order of the Chief Justice, we established a new governance structure that provided for all administrative policymaking of the judicial branch to be vested in a judicial council. This is a 25-member council, 19 voting judges, 6 administrators, judges of all levels, but 15 of the 19 judges are from the trial courts, including all 10 of the elected chief judges. And this body, as I say, is responsible now for all administrative policy making for the judicial branch. And this is the current administrative structure of the judiciary. The last of our goals for state funding is that it achieve cost efficiency and effectiveness. We immediately began to use that flexibility of state funding, where those in silos, 87 silos of independent funding and personnel systems disappeared. We now have a single enterprise and are able to allocate funding and to deliver services in a different way than when we were county-based. We began by flattening the management structure. We today have fully 40% of our courts have of our counties have a shared court administrator. Two of our 10 districts have a judicial district administrator that is shared, as well as a staff. We have developed a staffing study, which is similar to our weighted caseload study, that objectively, based on workload, tells us where we need to allocate staff. We're using this state funding flexibility to move staff and then work across county and district lines. We've totally restructured all of these state programs, the mandated services programs, collections, and the like, and have put in place statewide management oversight, consistent practices, minimum standards of training, best practices, and all of this has achieved improved outcomes at lower unit costs. We've established a statewide virtual self-help center, offloading the pro se litigation litigant workload in many cases from already overloaded court administration offices into an online kind of a system with a self with a help line back to Hennepin County, which is now the hub for the entire state. We also have instituted a statewide vendor contract for all of our collections statewide. And in just this last year, we've increased revenue to the state by $8.5 million. We've instituted MNSIS, is now a single statewide information system for the entire state. And this has led to more consistent business practices across the state. We used to have 10 separate databases. We now have a single one, and so we can access information statewide by case or by individual. The web-based technology is enhancing the information integration with our justice system partners. We process 35,000 messages between and among our business partners every day now. And all of this is leading to greater productivity improvement as we're trying to move towards much more automation with e-citations and e-complaints, online and phone payments of our payables, e-docs, moving more to a paperless environment in the future. And finally, we have established some core court performance measures as a policy of the Judicial Council for the entire judicial branch. And these are the six core measures that we have adopted: access to justice, timeliness in our resolution of our cases, integrity and accountability of our records, excellence in decision-making, fairness and equity, and the quality workplace for our employees. In this last biennium, 08 and 09, we have taken steps in three ways to determine how we're doing in terms of our performance. We have administered an access and fairness survey in all 100 of our locations to 7,700 court users to have them tell us how we're doing in terms of issues of both access and fairness. We have comprehensive timeliness reports, measuring against standards, time standards that we now have for all of the trial courts and for both the appellate courts, the Supreme Court, and the Court of Appeals. And we have also administered a quality court workplace questionnaire asking our employees for their views on a whole range of issues. And more than 70% of both judges and court employees responded to that survey. And we have all of this information now for the first time, really, to hold ourselves accountable as a branch of government to the public and to you and to ourselves. Strategic planning is another significant area that we have been able to achieve in a much more effective way as a result of state funding. Because we are now operating under a single source of funding, strategic planning has become much more effective because we can adopt certain priorities and then actually put money to it to make sure that they get implemented and achieved. The state, our judicial branch strategic plan is in your packets, and there are a number of initiatives under each of those that we are in the process of completing in this time period. But just to give you, a recollection of what some of those are, in this period of time, we have undertaken a very comprehensive children's justice initiative. We've begun a drug court initiative, putting in place in just a few years some 38 operating drug courts around the state. And as you'll hear in a few minutes, we are moving forward in an access and service delivery initiative. None of these would have been possible. These major initiatives that have really changed the culture in many ways without state funding. So let me turn now to judicial branch challenges. The year that we completed the state funding transition in FY04-05 was one of those years like the biennium we're about to go into with a significant deficit at the state level. So just as we were bringing on those big districts, we had a budget cut and an underfunding where we had to absorb a number of costs, including employee costs, $23 million short. In 06-07, there was no restoration of that cut. And then in this year now, we are also experiencing in this biennium a $19 million shortage. Well, what has that meant? Well, that's meant that we have had to reduce our staff. We're operating 9% short, and we now have a situation where we're holding open now judicial vacancies as well. With short staff, we're having to reduce our services. We've closed public counters in a number of districts, half a day a week, satellite court. We've terminated or reduced a number of services in the 4th District. We've cut our jury per diems, cut funding to drug courts, retired judges, mandated services. The public defender cuts have had all kinds of implications for CHIPS processing, and we have seen significant delays in processing cases and providing the other kinds of services that the courts do as a result of these shortages. And I would like to call on now our two chief judges from Hennepin and Ramsey County, Judge Swenson and Judge Kathy Guerin, and I'm going to ask them to give you a little more about these workload challenges, what we're experiencing today. So if I could have you two come forward.
Would you please state your name for the record, Judge?
I'm James T. Swenson. I'm the Chief Judge in the 4th Judicial District. That's Hennepin County.
And I'm Kathleen Guerin. I'm the Chief Judge in the 2nd Judicial District, which is, we're in it, which is Ramsey County, St. Paul, and suburbs.
Thank you.
Included in your packet were some case filing numbers. And in 2008, I believe it was, there was 1,963,000 filings in Minnesota, of which 1,740,000 of those were labeled as minor. The problem is none of those were minor to the people who had to come to court to get their redress. They certainly weren't minor to those charged with criminal proceedings. I'm here today to talk about those people, by and large. Those are the ones that we see on a regular basis and that we have to serve. Now, we started making some very serious cuts in the fall of 2007. And I might add, those were on top of the cuts we made in 2004 that we never refunded and never restored. And what's been so difficult for a lot of my colleagues and me to accept is that these cuts that we've been making have been visited upon the disadvantaged by and large. And there's a fundamental issue here about fairness, and our core mission is to provide equal access to justice to everybody, and that's seriously in jeopardy. We used to have an alternative dispute resolution program that was funded out of our budget, and this was used by a lot of people at the low end of the economic scale. In 2007, we had roughly 460 pairs of litigants who took advantage of that program, and 250 of the sets of litigants were able to settle their cases. We totally scuttled that program a year ago in the fall. We used to provide supervised parenting time for moms and dads in family court cases who needed that in order to be able to see their kids. We totally scuttled that last fall. We have what has been the model domestic abuse service center for the country. If you guys remember, in an attempt to get a better handle on the burgeoning domestic abuse, you asked us to create forms for victims of domestic abuse so they could get to court quickly, and then you wanted us to provide help so that they could fill out those forms. Hennepin took up the challenge, and we developed a domestic abuse service center, which is being replicated across the country. Last fall, we cut two positions from that domestic abuse service center, and what happened was horrendous. What you find is we've temporarily restored those through the end of this biennium through some vacancy factors, but what was happening is we'd have an abused man or woman coming to court, probably through public transportation early in the morning, arriving at court at 7:15, 7:30. They were already 19, 20 or so in line, and we never got to them before the day was done and they went back to the abusive environment. You heard Sue DoSalle talk about the self-help center, of which Hennepin is the hub. In large urban courts across America now, 71% of all civil cases have at least one self-represented person. Unless we're able to help them negotiate the court system, they become molasses in the system and it all breaks down. It's a really key part of what our core business is and all other courts across the country. We cut 1.5 positions from the self-help service center last fall. You've already heard that we cut jury hours. You heard that we cut jury fees. We now pay jurors less money to come down to our court and fulfill their civic duty than they, we pay them less than it costs to park. It's really quite dismaying. And we started cutting back in calendars. In conciliation court now, we're up to the point where it takes 6 months to have a hearing after you file your case. Not much of an effective remedy for somebody that needs their damage deposit back from their landlord so they can move into another apartment. Not effective remedy to a homeowner that's having a problem with the contractor and needs to have it resolved so they can finish their project or have a remedy if it was delayed. The situation is so fluid that I had to make some changes in my notes between this morning and this afternoon. And I'll give you an example. Processing judgments. We went from a system and scenario where we process judgments for people in 2 weeks to 4 weeks on a worst-case basis. My notes for today said we were up to 2 months. Well, I just found out we're now up to 2.5 months in processing judgments. And this is really, really problematic for people. Just yesterday, we had a gentleman who called our judgment department all frantic. He was transferred here from Washington, and he had to clear up a judgment in order to be able to close on his mortgage, had a very favorable rate. And the answer to him was not in these tough terms, but basically tough luck. You're at the bottom of the pile. We have stacks of cases waiting for judgments to be entered. All the people that need those judgments to be entered to collect on their debts to protect their property, we can't even get to them. One of the reasons for that, our default judgments have gone up 116% in the last decade. If you have an harassment case, if you need a hearing, it now takes 2 months to get a hearing. If you're on the adverse side where somebody got an ex parte hearing, you can't even get to court to try to overturn that for 2 months. And that harassment order might preclude you from seeing somebody that's near and dear, and you don't even have a remedy for 2 months. Our justice partners need the funding to the same extent we do. I see Jeremy Lane's here for Legal Aid. Legal Aid and the public defenders, adequate funding is absolutely essential. It's the same self-represented people or people without representation that we serve through our self-help center when they choose to go it alone. The public defenders and Legal Aid serves it when they absolutely need counsel and can't afford it. If they're not adequately funded, it's every bit as much molasses in the system as self-represented people that don't know what they're doing. In the last 2 months alone, our hearing examiners, we have hearing examiners that do judge-type functions. They hear a lot of our low-level traffic matters and provide people a day in court. Their workload is up 15% in the last 2 months. That's simply a facet of the all the people that have lost their jobs, and budgets are so tight that people are choosing to fight for every dollar that they possibly can to meet their budget. So they're coming to court in droves trying to winnow down their fee for a driving violation by $20 here, $30 there. The picture that I've painted, I think, is a very bleak one, and I think the real tragic part is that it's disproportionately being visited upon the poor, and that's something that we in Minnesota shouldn't be and can't be proud of. We certainly are not in Hennepin County.
Senator Moore, Senator Foley, and the members of the committee, thank you for having us here. I could echo exactly what Judge Swenson said. We are a smaller urban district, but we have mirror image, just not half the personnel, half the judges and judicial officers, and probably half the clients also. We see that we have the same effect is happening in our county. We have already in the 08-09 time period, where we will be cutting approximately 21 positions, which is about 8 to 9% of our staff. Most of those have already been cut. We've tried to do it by attrition. That doesn't always work perfectly because it may be a crucial position we have to refill. The effect is a practical matter. I 100% agree with what Judge Swenson has said. The effect is more upon the disadvantaged. It is more upon the abused. It is more upon the poor. But the effect is upon everybody. I'll give you some examples. In the criminal division, we've cut 1.5 hearing officers. It used to be people who are trying to get tickets straightened out, perhaps get the fines reduced in order for them to get their licenses back so they can maybe get a job in an area where they have to drive a car so that they can pay child support. I could go down the line. It gets worse as I talk. They don't have licenses. If they obey the law, they have to take the bus to get downtown or to one of the other places where we have hearing officers to hear them. We used to have one at the law enforcement center, and we don't have one there anymore. Now you have to come by appointment. It's hard for them to keep the appointment because they don't have the transportation. They're waiting long lines. They're more angry and frustrated when they do get a time to talk to a hearing officer. In the criminal division, we cut a lot of the cuts have been the clerical staff. A lot of the work has to be done. It's either being delayed being done, or it's ended up being done by people at a level sometimes the judges will even, I'm not saying this on a daily basis, but sometimes you'll get so frustrated because the staff can't get something that you send your clerk down to do essentially a clerical task so you can have your hearing. I note that there are times when we put people on probation, just probation to the court. They don't need the expense and the hassle of having a probation officer or the help that a probation officer can give. But they need to be held accountable. We say, as long as you're law-abiding, I won't see you again. Well, today it's getting to be, as long as you're law-abiding, and if we have enough staff to check your record to see if you broke the law, then I'll see you again. And some of the reports I'm getting are too late for me jurisdictionally to bring them back and do something because they committed a new offense, a probation violation, or some other, well, probation violation. In the civil division, we have the same issues with judgments being entered, with matters being filed. Civil attorneys are frustrated when they come in for a summary judgment hearing and the judges don't have the papers because they haven't been filed yet. The files are stacking, are beginning to already kind of stack up. We have a storage problem. Before we store files, they have to be imaged, they have to be, you know, electronically recorded. Then we can get rid of these big files. Now we're close to having to pay for storage in the county storage center, just because we don't have the clerical staff to keep up. We have the same types of backlogs growing in conciliation and housing court. The increase in frustration for the public at all levels, the poorest of the poor up to the wealthiest of the wealthy, is noticeable. Another area is child support, just to get the cases initiated. Now it takes about a week, or a year or two ago, I think a year and a half ago, it took a week to open a file from the time we got the child support report from the county attorney's office. Now it's taking 3 weeks. We had a referee who announced his retirement recently, and at this point, we don't know budget-wise whether we'll ever be able to replace him. And that means that from 1 week to 3 weeks, before you even get your file opened and put on the record, more or less get a hearing, people need that child support. That's affecting people. And I think it's going to grow. In our domestic abuse area, just I echo what Judge Swenson said. We know that this next biennium, we will vary, unless if our budget is anywhere near, I mean, we only hope it's not as severe as we think it will be, but we know that we will have to cut some of our domestic abuse workers. And that will mean that we'll soon have what Hennepin County has and people not being able to be processed. In adoptions, the adoption, we used to have a full-time person doing adoptions. Now that those are being delayed because that person has to help out when somebody gets sick in another area of juvenile court. So we aren't able to file and hear the adoptions as fast as we used to do to give those children the permanency and those families the happiness as quickly as we wish we could. I think that's probably enough bleakness. But we aren't ignoring the fact of the budget. I know you've got a tough task. I don't envy you on with the budget crisis. I know it's going to be a struggle for all of us. I'm also aware we have a duty as, you know, public officials to treat the taxpayers' money wisely. But there comes a time when we will not be able to do some of the essentials of justice. We're getting close to that. We're trying. We keep looking at, I guess you could call them efficiencies, but I must tell you, we know we need to be more efficient in some areas. We've
Sarah
been working at it.
Sarah, well,
but justice isn't always just efficient.
Don't run away.
Sarah,
well.
Well, first of all, thank you both for the information that you've provided. I think that we're very well aware of some of the structural difficulties. I mean, when you don't have the bodies to file the cases and do the work, that's an infrastructural issue that I think ties in with the funding issues. But I wondered if you could, so given that we understand that there's been cuts, and those cuts have led to perhaps reductions in the staffing. I'm hearing that's one of the drivers. But could you talk a little bit about whether or not you've also experienced a growth in the workload that's coming through the court? And can you share with us some observations of, so it's surely, I mean, surely the difficulty facing you all isn't just the budget cuts and not having the bodies.
I would say there has been, I think there's been growth in numbers in some areas. And Sunasal would be better handling that than me. I know that the weighted caseload statistics show we need 7 more judges in the state. We know we aren't going to get that. And we've even removed it from our budget, our original budget request. We've removed that. We've removed additional judge salaries. We've removed other salaries. we've removed jury stuff. We're aware of your of the budget issues. I think that where I see, even when the numbers in areas where the numbers haven't increased, what we have increased is more angry people, more frustrated people, more needy people, more people. We have a need. What we're doing is slower because of the anger and the frustration. And one of the issues that is rapidly increasing has been our need for interpreters. And that, I can't, that just, it slows down everything. It's so important that we do it. We have to do it. But it makes a case more time-consuming, and we have to be more careful to make sure that we have the understanding issues. So that even if in an area of, there may be some criminal areas where we haven't had a growth in number of cases, but we have had a growth in number of non-English speaking people in those cases.
Judge Guerin, I didn't see anybody representing the rural courts, but maybe
Judge Rodenberg will be up in a minute.
Oh, okay.
He's from New Ulm. We're supposed to call that Greater Minnesota, not rural.
We like rural.
Judge Swenson.
Well, in answer to your question, yeah, the numbers are up significantly in areas that are driven by the economy. Our foreclosures are up significantly. Our housing court filings are up. Our default judgments are up. But it's not just the case numbers that are up. In family court, for example, we used to always have the luxury of some home equity to use to settle a case, split it up. Now, more often than not, we're left with fighting over who's going to pay what debt. And because the economic circumstances are so dire, the people are fighting over every dollar unlike they used to before. So the work is harder, even though the cases might not be up in some areas. In the criminal area, although our statistics regarding the number of some serious felonies might not be up, the number of people involved as the defendants, we have just a ton of multiple defendant aggravated robberies and assaults, which when the lawyers want to have separate trials for each one of their defendants, that means we try more cases even though there are not more filings, and the legal issues get complex as the lawyers are fighting among each other about, you know, whose testimony we're going to try to preclude. And we've seen some other really difficult changes. When the funding got cut for CHIPS cases, Children in Need of Protection, and the prioritization in Hennepin County had a list of, let's say, 12 cases from the most serious to the less serious that they would handle, and they get cuts in their funding and they cut it off, let's say, at 7, then all those people have to go someplace. We've just seen an incredible increase of what should be in juvenile court coming over to the adversarial process of family court, the rise of third-party custody petition. That means grandma suing her granddaughter or aunt suing her niece to try to get custody. All that stuff that used to be handled in family group conferencing and things in juvenile court, now that's not in juvenile court, it's dumped in the laps in family court where we're ill-equipped to handle that stuff. People come over already at loggerheads, very, very vitriolic litigation, very time-intensive. We have had a quite serious increase in our workload. And the weighted caseload numbers, Judge Guerin said 7. I think the newest ones that just came out said we need 12 in the first year of the biennium. It's double that in the second year. And again, we're not asking for any new judges, but the need is crying.
Judge Guerin, did you?
No, I was kind of, perhaps, it's been over 22 years since I've been a prosecutor, but once in a while something comes out in my head. It was, when I was a young prosecutor, people used to kill somebody by themselves. Now it's like with big group. And they'll have like 5 or 6 defendants in most of our homicides. Not 5 or 6, but more than one defendant in most of our homicides now. And he's right. That's a big point, just assigning those cases and scheduling them.
When you're talking about the public defender and the others and the guardian ad litem, is that desirable way to go to look at a situation where you essentially have got so many folks in the courtroom. How can you, you know, justify not having a kind of a user-friendly type of approach versus a guardian ad litem, a public defender, and another public defender representing the father, and another one the mother? Are all of those folks necessary?
Senator Foley, you're referring, I think, to CHIPS cases.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. I still occasionally do CHIPS calendars. We need guardian ad litems in most of our CHIPS cases. That's why we're in there. The parents have not been adequately caring for the needs of those children. Regarding attorneys for the father, because of funding and funding issues, we are not doing it unless as often as we used to or as easily as we used to. The father or whoever the non-custodial parent is, sometimes it'll be the mom. We believe legally we have an obligation to provide them legal counsel. I can't think of a right more important than parental rights. I mean, it ranks it right up there with any other right. But for the fathers, I know a lot of judges around the state, fathers or non-custodial parent would be a better phrase, or one who hasn't established their parental rights legally in another court, but who just shows up that time. We are less likely to give them legal counsel, to be honest. We are not giving it as frequently.
I've heard that, yeah.
One thing you have to keep in mind when a child's involved is these aren't distinct pieces of litigation like a personal injury suit or a contract that are over and done. We retain jurisdiction as long as they're in their minority. And what you find out with guardians and public defenders is that they're very cost-effective. Because all the statistics nationwide will tell you that if you have settled family arrangements that are brokered through mediation, use of any type of alternative dispute resolution, their likelihood of coming back to court and costing more money and more time goes down dramatically. And we need to be able to communicate with people in order to resolve cases in a way favorable for them and their children. And many, many times, the guardians and the public defenders are the vehicle for us to be able to communicate and settle those cases. So in addition to our constitutional obligation to provide that representation, it's very cost-effective for us to resolve cases. The immediate cases are oftentimes less time-consuming and expensive, but over the continuum and the child emancipates, we save it. Ton of time and dough.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just given the reality of our budget difficulties, which, you know, we hear have this reiterated over and over, the significance of the problem, what may turn out to be as much as 20% of our overall state budget, and if we put a fence around one area, that just means greater reductions in another area. I mean, that's a really significant problem to be facing. So I guess what I'm asking is, it sounds like what you've just described, we've spent a lot of time in the state legislature focusing on reductions in one area of caseloads that I don't think are growing. In fact, I think our most of the tort reform proposals have been geared toward reducing cases that are actually declining anyway, and I think I heard something like a 40% decline in that caseload in the last 10 years. And yet we're doing other things that are increasing the time the courts are spending in areas where it seems like the caseload is growing or becoming more complicated. Are there some reforms or ideas, knowing the reality of, you know, I guess one thing that comes to my mind is, could we be focusing more on alternative dispute resolution and making it more mandatory and still staying within our constitutional framework? Or are there any other creative ideas you could offer that would help reduce expenses further?
Senator Foley, Senator Mola, I want to segue right. You've just provided the introduction for Judge Rodenberg. Judge Rodenberg is from the 5th District in New Ulm, and he is on the Judicial Council. He is also in charge of a group that the Chief Justice established in order to do exactly what you're talking about. He'll tell you about that. I'm going to defer to him.
Being technologically challenged, Senator Foley, I'm going to let Janet run the technology for me. For the record, my name is John Rodenberg. I'm a district court judge in New Ulm, Brown County. I am right now the vice chair of Minnesota's Judicial Council that Sue DeSalle talked about a while ago, and I did serve as chair of the Access and Service Delivery Committee, and I'm currently serving as chair of the ASD 2 committee that I'll talk about in just a few moments. As Judge Guerin just said, Senator Olson, it's almost as if you were a plant for our presentation. I know you weren't, but that does make a direct segue. If I could back up, though, just for one moment and go off my prepared remarks for just a bit, because Senator Foley requested maybe some input from the rural part of the state. I wasn't really going to talk about that because I want to focus on this access and service delivery information and material, but I do want to say that the things that Judge Swenson and Judge Guerin talked about are similar to things that we're experiencing in the rural parts of the state. A couple of the things that were mentioned in particular, the need for a greater number of interpreters is something that's really new to the rural parts of the state, southwest part of the state, but my district in particular. And that is a challenge in the budgetary times. We're not alone in that. Judge Swenson talked about legal aid. I know that the one case out of Rice County, another that's in the 3rd District, but the CHIPS situation that's emerging now of the unwillingness of the county board, or inability, I should say, it's not for me to judge, to fund attorneys for parents. It's my understanding that the case in question, a child has been returned back to that child's home in circumstances where it's questionable whether that would have happened otherwise. That is a tremendous risk that the public is going to be looking at for those kinds of cases. Just the last four files I looked at this morning, I drove up here after handling a morning calendar. First, at 11 o'clock, I handled a file where the defendant was charged with criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has not yet gotten the analysis of the DNA done. The prosecutor dismissed that case without prejudice on the record this morning. That gentleman walked out. He's presumed to be not guilty, mind you, but the proceedings are impaired by the lack of funding to the BCA. The next two files, the defendant, same defendant, is charged with molesting two different children in those files. Again, BCA, he's in custody. He's demanded a speedy trial. Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has not gotten the information to the prosecutor. That one's on the verge of being dismissed. And the fourth of those cases was a young man who's going to turn 18 in February. He ran from a placement, and the position of the county was, we can't spend any more money on this young man. We'll pick him up in the criminal system after February. So the realities out in the rural parts of the state have a lot in common with the things you've heard from Judge Swenson and Judge Guerin. I'm not going to spend a lot of more time on that, but I do want to respond to just briefly to one thing I heard from Senator Foley.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Judge Rodenberg.
Judge Rodenberg, yes.
Rodenberg, sorry. How much correspondence, phone calling is done back and forth between the courts and the BCA at the crime lab in a situation that you were just talking about?
Senator Foley, may I respond?
Proceed.
In that situation, the interface between the BCA and the system is really through the county attorney's office. The assistant county attorney who was appearing in these hearings told me there had been numerous letters and phone calls, but I can't say that I had none. That was the prosecutor's responsibility. But certainly those situations are troubling when the court is, because of any player, whether it's public defenders, guardians ad litem, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the whole thing has to work as a system, and when one piece is missing, the machine doesn't run.
You were talking earlier about the people that are in the courtroom, and I'm losing track where I'm trying to go. But
can I ask, Senator, I'm a little hard of hearing. Can you speak a little louder, please?
I haven't gotten anything much to say, but I'm concerned about interpreters and the fact that there's a rapidly growing number of them, but you also have to recognize that a lot of those people should be helping the police officer and other public service people that they're not getting proper help in that situation. Senator Ingemar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of bouncing all around. I probably should have asked these questions before when the court administrator was giving her presentation, but maybe give me a little idea. I come from that 90 era when the 8th Judicial District was put into that trial period, and at that time there was talk about interactive TV with the judiciary, as well as not necessarily so much criminal, but the civil angle of that. Bless you. The civil angles, commitments, things like that, the mentally ill and whatnot, and instead of my part in that was, of course, transporting these people back and forth. Can you give me some idea where that's at, if that's even going on? I should know that, and I don't. And another one was, question I had was, with regards to the civil arbitrations. Now, I'm being told of service reductions when you're doing a terminated arbitration service, when I know that some of those are ordered by the court and paid for by both the plaintiff and the respondent. How would we see that affecting the budget area? And I'm sure those are probably court-ordered ones that are being paid for by the public. And can you enlighten me a little bit more on that arbitration and also the interactive TV thing?
Senator Foley.
That's what happened. Thanks.
I need to get to my remarks, because I now have two senators who have given me a perfect segue to the rest of my remarks, and so let me I won't have a third strike. Let me hit the second one. I want to talk a little bit about the Access and Service Delivery Committee, the work that was done, and I think, Senator Ingebrigtsen, you'll find that some of the information we're presenting is going to be directly on point to some of the questions you're asking, and if you have follow-ups, please, we want to do that. But in the February meeting 2008 now of the Judicial Council, we started to recognize that the budget condition going forward in 2008 and into 2009 was going to have substantial challenges. And as we looked at that situation then, we recognized at the council level that this was a longer-term problem and one that wasn't going to be susceptible of quick fix or something that we could just ride out the storm and things would change significantly. We recognize that healthcare spending with an aging society is going to increase, that as society ages, there's going to be a shift in governmental priorities. Older voters are tending to be more fiscally conservative, and the state tax base is going to be affected. At the council level, we looked at this as imposing twin challenges going forward into the future. First, we were going to have significant budget constraints near and long term. As Sue talked about, in the last few years, the judiciary has sustained shortfalls that are very significant in context. We're in the midst of one right now. And we recognize that going forward, we can't reasonably anticipate that you're going to be able to increase our funding so that we can staff at 100% of the levels that we have historically determined to be necessary. We also recognize that as more people are leaving the workforce than are coming in, and that's unique now it has not been the case, but now there are more people reaching age 62 than there are entering school. And so going forward, that's going to mean a smaller workforce, and we as an employer in the judiciary need to take that into account. As a result of those and other considerations, the Access and Service Delivery Work Group was created, as noted by others. Chief Justice Russell Anderson appointed the group, and I had the privilege of chairing the Access and Service Delivery Work Group, which you'll see referred to from time to time as the ASD Work Group. The purpose of that was to develop options for restructuring delivery systems, and Senator Ingebrigtsen, this is kind of on point of your question, redesigning our business processes, expanding the use of technology, and prioritizing what we do to give appropriate levels of access and service statewide at the lowest cost. The next slide might seem to be a little bit busy, but I want to take just a moment to talk about that because it might be important for you as senators to know what our employee group looks like, the cases that we work on, where is the work being done currently and by whom. We currently have 1,500 people statewide working in case-related staff. That would be staff who are processing files as they come in, serving in the courtroom, and things like that. It would not include the IT people. It would not include people in state court administration and things like that. We have 1,500 case-related staff statewide. Statewide, we have 460 people working on minor criminal matters. This, Senator Olson, goes a little bit to what your question was relating to the prioritizing of things and where we might look to gain efficiencies. We have 116 staff statewide working on payable offenses. That would be if you get a speeding ticket, you have to pay it at the courthouse. Someone's got to type in on Mensis that you paid your ticket and what have you. There's 116 people statewide doing that sort of work. Statewide, there are 241 court administration staff working in the courtroom. I emphasize court administration because that does not include court reporter and law clerk. Those are in the judge unit, the judge, court reporter, and law clerk. There's 241 more people statewide staffing the courtroom from court administrators. The smallest courts, the 17 smallest courts, those are the courts that have a weighted caseload need of 0.5 or less. Is that correct, Janet? 0.5 or less. So that would be counties like Lincoln County out on the South Dakota border in my district, or I know there are some up in the northwestern part of the state, and I think in the very Arrowhead, in the tip along the north shore of Lake Superior, there's one or two counties as well. In those 17 counties, there are a total of 38 full-time equivalents working. The reason that that's significant to us as we were doing work on the Access and Service Delivery Committee was one of the things we looked at was what happens if we just close those 17 court locations? What would be the efficiencies that we would gain? Well, there's only 38 people working there in those 17 locations. We don't really save much by closing those locations. And correspondingly, as far as I know, the people in Lincoln County aren't going to quit getting divorces because we closed their courthouse. The police officers in Lincoln County, I don't think, are going to let people drive drunk just because we don't have a court there. So we still have that work to do, even though we closed the location. So from the standpoint of trying to figure out what makes sense going forward, closing those 17 locations was considered early on and was really decided not to do that based upon we weren't going to save that much and the work was going to have to be shifted somewhere else anyway. So that was rather rapidly taken off the table. Our review of systems and ways of going about the doing of business included our looking at the banking industry. When I got my first job at the Kaiserhof in New Ulm, I was in high school, and I would be given a check at the end of every two-week pay period by Hildy Lewinsky, rest her soul. She was a wonderful woman. She gave me a piece of paper, and I would carry that piece of paper down to the Farmers and Merchants State Bank about a block and a half from the Kaiserhof, and I would stand in line. And there were probably about a dozen teller windows, and there was people in all of those teller windows, and I actually stood in line to get my piece of paper up to the window. It was a very paper-intensive system. If we look at the way banks operate now, and they have really done a tremendous transformation in the way they do their business, I don't even see my paycheck from the state of Minnesota. I suppose that it's out there somehow, but I don't see it. I'm going to get paid again Friday, I think, aren't I, if it all goes well? It's going to be directly deposited into my account. I don't go to the Farmers and Merchants Bank anymore, except on those rare occasions when I have some special need. When I do, there's hardly anybody in those windows anymore. There just aren't. Nevertheless, I get the service that I need. In fact, I'm going to arrive late home from my appearance here today, but if I want to get cash, I not only don't have to see anybody about it, I can just go to this magic machine, and if I remember my password, I can get cash out of that machine. And so, you know, we got to thinking, maybe use of electronics, and that, again, this gets to the question you're raising, we can maybe use electronics and use in technology more efficiently than we have and become less paper dependent and do more things by the use of technology. We ended up recommending, and the ASD committee report is in your materials. It's quite lengthy. I do encourage you to read it. A lot of work. I don't take that much pride of authorship because it wasn't my work. It was the work of the committee and the work of staff who really brought that together. But I think there's a lot of good ideas in there, and I do urge you for follow-up to the information I'm going to convey to take a look at that. We recommended that we look at staffing to the most efficient norm. Historically, and Sue Dosell talked about this, historically there were 87 different court systems, really. There were 87 county courts. And what we have now gotten to is a single system in which we're able to transfer and spread workload and employees. So we think we're going to be able, using technologies and the strategies we've identified, instead of staffing the Lincoln County Courthouse, to use my example, as a freestanding entity that requires three people, I don't know what it requires, we can look at the caseload there and staff it at the same level as it would be staffed in New Ulm, Mankato, Rochester, or even Minneapolis, by putting them together with other units out there and allowing them to share work across those county boundaries that wouldn't have been possible at an earlier point in time. Workflow reengineering in the electronic environment, I'm going to spend some time talking about that because that's directly on your point. Legislative and court policy reform and structural and governance issues. In order to staff to the most efficient norm, there are some things we're going to have to do. And in the early going, we've identified centralizing the processing of payables as being a critically important component. Senator Olson, this relates to your question. We're spending a lot of time, and staff is spending a lot of time, processing those speeding tickets, driving after revocation tickets, what have you. If we can centralize that, that takes a million something, 1.2 million? Of our 2 million filings and put them in a central location. We think we can gain tremendous efficiencies if we do that. Other centralized case processing. This one is not so much a matter of saving money as it is of doing business better. We currently do annual reviews of guardianships and conservatorships in all 87 counties and multiple locations in some of the counties. To be truthful, it's haphazard in some locations. It's done in some places better than others. Dean Moss in Judge Guerin's courthouse is working on and has developed programming and software that will allow for a better, not just more efficient, but better review of those annual accounts. If we can take that function and either centralize or regionalize it, we think we can both gain some efficiencies and do a better job in those guardianship and conservatorship cases. There are some things that we believe we can either do by ITV or by using per diem or volunteer attorneys. That's being done in Hennepin and Ramsey counties, and we're looking into that. In the rural parts of the state, we have used ITV in some locations for conciliation court. We may have to have some rule changes for some of those things, but it's something that we have to go forward and explore.
Judge Bronberg, what is ITV?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Senator Moore. That's interactive television.
Okay.
And all of our courtrooms are now equipped with that technology. And I conduct those hearings with some, well, not weekly, but certainly monthly. We have a hearing of someone who needs to be seen, who is in custody in a location where there isn't a judge available. And that happens out in our part of the state. St. James, which is not a small county seat, it has a 0.9 weighted caseload, went for 2 years without a judge. So we handle things by interactive television, and it can be done. It's not ideal, but we can gain some efficiencies by using that technology. We also need to look at redesigning courtroom support duties. As was noted, there's a certain number of court administration staff in the courtroom, but each judge unit is a judge, court reporter, and law clerk, and we need to look at how to most efficiently deploy that judge unit to try and assist with court administration work, to put it bluntly. We need to make sure that those people are working as efficiently and as good as they can so that they can help to staff the cases and staff the courtrooms, because court administration is staffed currently at about 85%, somewhere in that range. In the workflow reengineering area, the e-filing initiatives are something that we think has to be aggressively pursued. The e-citation, e-complaint, e-filing, auto-assess, and interactive voice recognition, interactive web payment are what is referred to by our technology people as the trifecta. Right now, when you get a written ticket from law enforcement, when you get a written ticket from law enforcement, the original of the ticket is filed with my court. Someone in court administration takes that written piece of paper. It's kind of like when I was working at the Kaiser office. They take that written piece of paper and they plug it into Minsis. I think someone in law enforcement has probably plugged it into their system too, so you got two sets of hands on the keyboard as well. Then the person comes into our court and they handle their ticket. The payment is taken by hand, you know, check or cash or whatever at the window. We do take credit cards, but it's handled in hand at the window, and then they key into Minsis that the ticket got paid. We envision a system where if we have an e-citation system, the officer can enter the ticket electronically and transfer the ticket information to court administration electronically. The Minsis system and the related functionality should be able to generate notices from that information, because driver's license information will be there, as to you must pay or appear by such and such a date. And using telephone and or web payment options, people may be able to do just like you do if you want to find out what's the balance on your Discover card. You dial it in and you push in your card number and, I don't know, your mother's maiden name and your Social Security number and whatever else you put in, and it'll tell you. And you can pay those things online, and the same would be true with web payment. So if we come up with a system like that, if we can develop a system like that, a citation may go all the way from law enforcement through payment and be closed without anyone in our court system placing hands on it at all, bearing in mind that that's 1.2 million of our 2 million case filings each year. Now, not all of them are going to go that way, but if a significant number of them do, we can get tremendous efficiencies from that.
Senator Higgins?
Yes, I'm sorry.
And I'm sure this is probably a question more for Ms. Marshall. Along the line of electronic documents and various efficiencies and better ways to do things, 2 years ago, the legislature required that the orders for protection and protection and whatever,
domestic abuse,
have the photo of the person who should be kept away on the document. And in committee yesterday, Madam Chair, we found out it's still not being done. And when will it be done? Because it had better be like in the next month or so. Because it's been 2 years.
Ms. Marshall?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janet Marshall with the State Court Administrator's Office. I can tell you, I am not working on that project because I don't work in the technology department. I can tell you that it has taken almost 2 years to figure out the business practice and the technology to pass the domestic abuse orders for protection to the BCA system. That was just accomplished within the last 3 months. It's due to different technology systems. It's due to very complicated requirements of the FBI. And so it took 2 years to accomplish that. The next piece of their work, I know they are working on the photo piece. When we were given this requirement, I must say, when we were given this requirement, we said we didn't think we could do it, but we still were told to do it, and we are trying the best we can. It's very complicated. It has to do with computers and computers talking to each other and changing business practices and complying with the FBI. But I will see where they are in that project, and I will get back to you.
Madam Chair, thank you, Ms. Marshall. I have to say, I'm stunned, I'm shocked, I'm appalled. And I'm getting really close to being really angry about the fact that this isn't done. This is the law. It is to be done this way, and we have to get it done. This is one of those circumstances where it's people's lives that we're talking about. And I am so frustrated and so angry about this. I don't know where to go next, but I'll figure something else out.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I mean, I remember quite specifically the many, many problems you had, one in particular. You have somebody comes in with one photo. Where does the photo go? Does it go in the judge's file? You attach it to the order? What do you do? And the courts made it quite clear. They said, first of all, we're not equipped to do this. And if you want to give us money to do it, we'll find a way. But there's other organizations. We've got to work with the BCA and so forth. We never gave them the money to do it. We gave them a directive to do it. But they told us all the problems and the barriers and the obstacles, and we ignored it. We just said, go ahead and do it. And frankly, the bill was poorly written. It was not well thought of, you know, and we gave them a direction. And, you know, frankly, I think if I remember the language, I don't have it in front of me, but it was muddied language to start with. So, you know, I mean, we had some problems at our end, too.
Madam Chair, Senator,
Senator Higgins.
A scanner costs $100. Pretty much every copy machine made these days scans. If you have one copy of a photo, put it on the scanner, scan it. It's now electronic, and it can go anywhere and everywhere. It's 2009. You know, these are things that technology can make happen if somebody has the will to do it. And it seems to me nobody has the will to do this.
Ms. Marshall?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, it's not that we don't have the will and we are trying. It is a little more complicated than that, because often with the domestic abuse protection orders, neither the victim nor the perpetrator is there. So neither of them have a picture to give to us. And we can't, we're trying to work on this. We know it's serious. We are not trying to minimize it. We are trying, with the staff we have available and all the other mandates that we are given, we are taking this seriously.
And members, I seem to recall that when the court said that there would be some difficulty, and I seem to recall Ms. Marshall made that exact point, which is that how do we get access to the photos? And I think what tipped us in terms of passing that piece of legislation was that the BCA and the Department of Vehicle Services were saying that because people's driver's license photos were on file, that perhaps there's an avenue, an opportunity for the BCA to work with Driver and Vehicle Services to get access to those photos and to import them. And so in a way, I think that's why we sort of engineered ourselves out of acknowledging that it would be a difficult budget burden for the courts, because I think the testimony was that between the BCA and Vehicle Services, they would find some way to get the photos onto those documents. Now, if that isn't the case, Ms. Marshall, I am very interested in revisiting the issue, and we would like, in fact, we will invite you to come back and visit with us about that. We all learn, and we respect the court's input, and I think this is one instance where I think that we all felt very moved by the specific case that brought the piece of legislation to the legislature. I think that we all have good intent, but if we're not able to achieve the outcome that we want, we definitely should revisit the circumstances and see if I do recall very specifically that there was testimony that between the BCA and Department of Vehicle Services that we would have the photos available. And if that's not the case, then I think that we ought to revisit the conversation. So, you know, Senator Higgins is in the room today. I'm here. Senator Foley's here. I think you've got all the three chairs in the Senate dealing with the issue on hand, and we'll bring that back for another visit. But let's move on to the rest of the information. Judge Rodenberg.
Thank you, Senator. I think you can flip to the next. Another thing that the ASD committee strongly recommended and the council eventually adopted was making legislative and court policy reforms. We've already started on the expansion of the payables list. The council's done some significant work on that already. We want to further expand the number of items that are payable so that we can spend less time on the low-level cases and spend more time on the more significant cases. We want to include on the payables list statewide local ordinances. Local ordinances historically have not been on the payables list. They've been handled from location to location. We would like to move forward and have those ordinance violations be also on the payables list. An example might be disorderly conduct might be made a payable on the state statute, but then most city ordinances have a same or similar ordinance violation. It shouldn't matter whether it's payable that it's written, one ticket's written on the state statute and the other one's written on the city ordinance. So we want to bring some conformity and expand the number of payables on ordinance violations as well. We are moving toward making all misdemeanors that have a fine under $300 payable, therefore not requiring a court appearance, and therefore not likely requiring the appointment of a public defender. Many folks will pay if they have that option rather than make the appearance in court. If they just pay, they don't ever get the advisory, do you want a lawyer? If you ask less people, we expect you'll receive less answers to the question of do you want a public defender. So we think that's one that might help our system, and it might help the public defender system as well. We're also looking at pursuing legislation to reduce workloads. Senator Foley already has some work done in that area that we're going to want to be talking to him about going forward. And then shifting some driver's license duties to the Department of Vehicle Services or Department of Public Safety. The courts over the years have taken on some of the responsibilities that we think more appropriately should belong with DPS or DVS in terms of insurance information and things of that sort. We want to shift those things where they belong elsewhere into other agencies or entities. We are a very creative bunch in the judicial branch. As a result of the access and service delivery work, we created two work groups going forward, and we wanted to come up with very flowery and descriptive names for them, and so we came up with ASD1 and ASD2. The ASD1 group is chaired by Judge Lucy Wieland of Hennepin County, former chief judge of the Judge Swenson's immediate predecessor, and ASD2 is chaired by myself. The ASD1 group is looking at the nearer term activities, the things that can be done in the nearer term. Now, near term requires some explanation. Nearer term isn't tomorrow or next week or next month. The nearer term priorities are those things that we can reasonably expect in the next year or two. So that these are things that are require some work. For example, and you can see, you know, centralizing and automating the processing of payable expenses and getting to that electronic trifecta is something we think should be moved way to the front of the line. There's some tremendous efficiencies to be obtained. But that's not something you do over the weekend when you don't have anything else to do. It does also require some technological upgrades because some of the places that will most need the assistance in remote parts of the state don't currently have the wide area network capable of doing all the things we need them to do. So there's going to have to be some expenditure in some areas of the state. In-court updating is another area we want to move into. That doesn't really save much in the line of FTEs, but it does reduce redundant clerical work. Currently, when I was in court this morning, again for an example, my court clerk was in there with me. She was taking notes and doing some things on the computer, but basically she took the stack of, I don't know how many files I handled this morning, probably 50 or 70. She took them into her office, and she's probably doing that now, updating Mensis to bring up to speed what happened in the morning. But, she's sort of doing 8 hours of work to cover 4 hours of court time. If that could be done in court and update Mensis in court, we think we can get some efficiencies there. The other benefit is to law enforcement. If there's a warrant goes out in court and they're updating it in court, law enforcement can be aware online of the existence of that warrant at the moment I issue it, not when the court clerk has time to go back and enter it. And that gets actually to something that Judge Swenson was talking about. When the clerical backlog is there and these things aren't happening, just like the fellow from Washington who needed his judgment satisfied, there's someone out there who's got a no-contact order from some order that I just entered in court. But if law enforcement hasn't got that information, I'm just talking. Law enforcement has to have that information to be able to act on the order. We also are expanding that list of payables, and I've talked about that a little bit already. Lucy's group is working on that in more detail. Structural and governance issues, we're looking at combining districts administratively. In your map, you can see that there's 10 districts. First of all, we're not really sure that we need 10 districts. And if we have 10 districts, we're not at all sure that we need 10 complete district administrations. The 7th and 8th districts are currently sharing a district administrator, and I am given to understand, although I don't work in that area, I am told that things work quite smoothly up in that area, and they've managed to save six figures and above each year as a result of that combining of administrations. Now, there's some possibility. Maybe that could be done in the 3rd and the 5th. Maybe it could be done in the 6th and the 9th. Maybe there are some ways we could share some of the district administration expense. So we're going to look at that. Subordinate judicial positions, we are looking at, and my group is going to be working on, actually going forth here February 4th, we're making a visit over to Hennepin County to take a look at how Hennepin County does some of their work with hearing officers and the like to handle low-level matters such as conciliation court and citations. Perhaps that model that's being used in Hennepin County and being used in Ramsey County with considerable success could be taken out into the rural parts of the state, greater Minnesota, possibly by using ITV or possibly by using per diem attorneys in these locations to handle those lower-level matters for us. It might be cheaper for us as a system to hire an attorney to do work for a couple hundred dollars and offload that work and not be asking you for more judges, like the 12 that I guess we need now and the 24 we think we're going to need by the end of the current biennium. The next slide tells you about the ASD1 activities. I think I've talked about most of those already. The ASD2 group, that is the group that I am chairing, which is the longer-term priorities. We're going to look at re-engineering the courtroom and judicial staff duties. As I indicated a while ago now, we need to look at how to most efficiently deploy the personnel we have, and that includes our law clerks and court reporters, to make sure we're using them wisely and efficiently. And we want to take a look at how we do that. We're also looking at this expansion of subordinate judicial officers, the structural issues, that is the redistricting, and the legislative and court policy reforms to reduce workload. As I said, the entire report is in your materials. It was done very rapidly between, this report was delivered July 17th, and as I said at the very outset some while ago now, the group was first comprised in February. So we really got in there and did a lot of in-depth work in quite a short period of time to try and get at these longer-term things. We think we really have got some efficiencies that we can obtain. And like the bank, it's not just efficiencies. We think there are some things, if we can move in these directions, we can not only obtain those efficiencies, but we can also keep up the level of service that not just the public expects, but that the Constitution requires.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to indicate that the CRIMNET process has been ongoing. I've been on that committee for 12 years, and we're in a situation where if you're looking at documents, pictures and so forth, that you also need some biometric identification that we don't in many cases. And so you can't enter something in the files or the NCIC, or the Mensis, or the thing in Minnesota, without an identifier, and that's where we've had trouble with. They had, I don't know, 10,000 warrants 12 years ago, and now they still have that same number. So there's some clear there. I want to say that really appreciate your coming here today, and we know that you've got some serious problems, and we're working to do what we can to ameliorate those, but I'm not at all optimistic that we'll have any more money at the end of the month than we currently have.
Judge Swenson.
Madam Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen had a question earlier that they deferred, and I just wanted to answer that on the ADR. By rule, everybody in a civil case has to have an alternative dispute resolution program. We push that very hard in most cases. Success with ADR. The program that I was talking about was one that we had in place for the people that couldn't afford it. And, you know, it's one thing for me to tell somebody that they have to do the alternative dispute resolution, but if they can't pay the vendor, they can't pay the vendor. And we had a program that we had to stop because of that. We're trying to replicate it. We've got one large law firm that's volunteered to do a lot of it. We're trying to restore it on a volunteer basis, just so you understand.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Just to follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So that was a program that was terminated then. My question, I guess, is the vendor, the arbitrated services, how do you pick arbitrators? And I guess that's my only question.
First of
Judge
all,
Swenson.
Senator and Chairman, it's a choice between mediation, arbitration, sorts of other possibilities. So sometimes it's arbitrator that can be binding, it can be non-binding. They can agree to submit it to something like the American Arbitration Association. They can pick from a list of approved and trained neutrals. There's many different ways to come up with the arbitrator, but wise counsel would allow the people to pick. There's much better chance for them to have buy-in. They agree that this person is the expert we want to do it rather than for me to shove it down their throat.
Judge Guerin.
Yeah, a couple clarifications on a couple points that Judge Rodenberg, maybe I'm just being picky, but he said all of our courtrooms have ITV. He meant in his district where they need it. We, for example, we don't need the IT. We may need it for some things in the future, but we don't have the ability to do that, and I think it would be a poor expenditure of money in an urban area to have every courtroom wired for ITV. We don't need it. Another thing regarding all those traffic tickets, when I was listening to them, I thought, I wonder if they're going to think, if we can get rid of 1.2 million, we won't need all these people. Well, two of the major urban districts, Hennepin and Ramsey, we're already doing that by electronically. We have systems that may or may not may be adopted by the rest of the state. And there are obstacles to that because it's dependent upon patrol officers having the equipment they need to enter the citations immediately also. But it's something our vision is that will become statewide at some point. Sorry, thank you.
Senator Olson and then Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And really to all of you, I guess to follow up with the question of ADR, I mean, I used to practice law and I in civil litigation, so I know how that works. I also know that it's, really as valuable as both parties are willing to make it. It usually doesn't happen until very late in the process. And, it isn't, it's in some cases it's very effective. In other cases it's just kind of a going through the motions thing because you have to. It seems to me, if I'm recalling correctly, that there are other states like California, maybe Hawaii, that have a much stronger mandatory alternative court system in terms of utilizing ADR, more mandatory arbitration, that type of thing. And I'm just wondering if that is an option that's been looked at and what your reaction to that would be if you think there would be cost savings there.
Judge Swenson.
Madam Chair, Senators, If anybody's doing it in a more efficient, better way than we are, we're always looking how to do it. In family court in Hennepin County, everybody comes to Hennepin County from across the country to be trained on how to use alternative dispute resolution. We're the gold standard. And there's lots of places within our courts where we use various forms of ADR as well, if not better than anybody else. When we put together our early neutral evaluation program, we scoured the country for anybody that was doing it, and the only one that was doing it was New Jersey, and they didn't even have their first session until a year into the case, hardly early. In ours, they do it within 3 to 4 weeks after filing, and it settles around 75% of the cases before even a month is done.
Judge Guerin.
Senator Rowland, committee members, we're learning how to use it better. The lawyers, law schools are now beginning to teach mediation courses. They and wise students take them. Some law schools, I think it's mandatory that they take some mediation training. Mediators are getting to be better. We put out, this court has rules and requirements for official mediators. And lastly, judges are being trained more on how to introduce mediation to people, how to require it, who to pick, and how to do, you know, some of those techniques ourselves. All of this has been ongoing. It is a growing thing in Minnesota. I think we're doing pretty well. We can always do better. I don't think we're too far from what California does. Now, I might be wrong. Thank you.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I was thinking about the payables list, and I looked at a draft of it, and it looked to me like there were a lot of items on there that were violations of city ordinances, those kinds of things. And I was wondering whether the committee had an opportunity to talk to, you know, probably the two big cities, because they probably do more of it than anybody else, in how that would affect their making sure that their city ordinances were being followed by people who are not necessarily doing a good job of that.
Judge Rodenberg.
Thank you, Senator Moore. Senator Higgins, we did communicate and are continuing to communicate with the municipalities and with the Association of Minnesota Counties, League of Minnesota Cities, et cetera. Truthfully, the kickback has been less in the metro area and more in the rural area. Some of the things that are added on payables, well, maybe not.
Not in St. Paul.
Hennepin County, at least. Some of the things that are on the payable list are currently already in. Judge Swenson can probably help me with this, but there are already understandings with the city attorneys that those things can be handled through the hearing office and dealt with as mitigated fines. I will say that there's been a significant kickback on some of the areas from some of the stakeholders. To be perfectly candid, if we could give the attention to all of those 1.2 million filings that we would like to give to it, we would be glad to. But if we are underfunded and funded at 92% of what we need, we have to decide which 8% we're not going to do. And the 8% we're not going to do can't include the civil cases. Those cases need to go forward. It can't include serious criminal cases. It can't include your orders for protection and harassment restraining orders. We have to stop doing something. And that's very likely what we're going to stop doing.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Judge, I have one more thing to go on your list. The public defenders were telling me the other day that it's a misdemeanor to not return your library book, and that there are sometimes when they are called into court to defend somebody because they didn't take the library book back to the library on time. So that might be another one that might maybe want to go on your list at some point.
Senator Rodenberg.
Senator Higgins.
We passed the law, so, yeah. You know, it's all called.
I would agree, actually, and you will see that in the materials that we are advancing going forward, we think that a serious look should be taken at the Non-Felony Enforcement Advisory Committee work that was done by Sudocel some years back. Really, I think all of the legislative enactments over the years have had their reason and have had their point at that point in time. But what we've ended up with is, with all due respect, a confusing set of rules from time to time that makes not returning a library book more serious than something which self-evidently is more serious. And a global look at the whole thing should be taken at some point. I couldn't agree more.
Judge Guerin.
Senator Moen and members of the committee. And Senator Higgins said, we cannot do this without a great deal of tension. In my county, my district, my county, there's a lot of resentment. There's a lot of not bad feelings, but I mean, they understand, but they're feeling, they don't like the fact that we are making payables, for example, violations of noise ordinance, the loud parties down by St. Thomas College. Out of respect, I hope nobody graduated from there here. I will be teaching there later tonight. But
around the university in Minneapolis.
Yeah, and those are neighborhood things, and neighborhoods are very upset about that. Judge Bill Johnson from down in Northfield feels that same way. It's a very important thing. But we cannot respond to the budget issues we have without doing things we would like to do, and we have to responsibly choose what it is. We can't do any more that we would still like to do.
Judge Rodenberg, I wonder if you could comment on whether or not in the studies that were done or the conversations you had, any thought was given to, and maybe I just don't know enough, but you know, I've recently developed an interest in all those fees and surcharges that we keep putting on our tickets and those court fees, and but particularly for the violations and the fees and surcharges. And then there's a very intricate map of how you disseminate those fees and surcharges, and I believe that the court has the responsibility to do that. And I wonder if you could I wonder if there was some conversations around that. I mean, is that process burdensome, or are you at a point technologically where you can just kind of zap a button and it automatically gets split up? Or how do you manage that?
You've asked an excellent question, Senator Moore, and I'm not able to answer it very well because that's not my strong area. But I know that those fee splits are tremendously complex and that they are not the same from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, again, as a result of things that have gotten overlaid over the years. Janet can maybe help me a little bit, but my understanding is if we're going to do the auto assess, we're going to, if we didn't change the law on those fee splits, we're going to have to program the computers 87 different times because the fee splits are not the same from county to county. But I can't tell you details because I'm not a detail guy on that subject.
Madam Ms. Chair, Marshall? Members of the committee, that is the one initiative that we are bringing forward this year, is that we're going to ask for help. In order for us to do this auto assessment, of part of our version of where we want to go is that no matter where you are, you put the ticket in and the computer will automatically do the splits for you. We do have to come in and we do have to ask that some of the statutes be changed and perhaps some changes be made in how people get some of the money they get now and where it goes. And we are coming forward with that initiative.
I would think that from an efficiency standpoint, while these automated systems are being set up, that it's worth looking at that so that we don't end up coming back at some point and have to, I mean, you only write the computer program at least, you know, once, and so we ought to think about that. Right. Ms. Marshall?
Yes, Madam Chair. Part of our initiative would be to clarify some of the statutes. For example, if you get charged with a DWI, the split of your DWI fund fine depends on what kind of a vehicle you were driving when you committed DWI. If it's an off-road vehicle, it goes to parts of it go to DNR. If it's a car, it was a state patrol, parts go someplace else. So right now, court staff has a difficult time even figuring out where the fine money goes because they don't know what vehicle was involved. So that if we could clarify the statutes, that maybe they'd have different statute numbers. If it was a snowmobile, it would have this statute number. And then that way, that could be put into our computer, and the right people would get the right money, and it would be clarified for everyone.
All right. Well, any other questions or comments from the members? We are fast approaching our 5 o'clock time. To the three judges, thank you very much. Judge Rodenberg, thank you for making the trip here, to Ms. Dosell and Ms. Marshall. Before we finish, I just want to say that we should be proud. Ms. Dosell has just been given an award, the 2008 Warren E. Berger Award from the National Center for State Courts. And they specifically talked about her being that she was the catalyst behind the 15-year transformation of the Minnesota judicial system from 87 county-based entities to a unified system, and lots of other very nice things that they talk about her. And I have to say that, having been involved in the Senate Judiciary Committee, I've been given opportunity to interact with other people with interest in judiciary from other states, and there is a tremendous amount of respect and recognition for the tremendous work that is being done in the state. And let us hope that despite the hard times, that your good work will help us to continue to live up to our expectations and to our good reputation, our good name, and not just resting on that good reputation. So thank you all very much, and we stand adjourned.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, the library thing is a petty.